Okay, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning Torah study. Thanks for joining with us today. I did have a couple of announcements before we get started today. And remember, if you will, I just got a notice this morning that some of you know Glenn Chatterton. Glenn and Rhonda's daughter, Connie, one of their sons, Morgan, is in the hospital right now dealing with some sort of reaction, and so they asked for prayers, so keep little Morgan in your prayers. The note that I saw suggested they thought it was something to do with a reaction to an antibiotic or something, so he's really broken out, and they're at the hospital right now, so keep Morgan in your prayers. Speaking of babies, baby Owen, my number six grandchild, is doing much, much better. Thanks for your prayers, your thoughts, and good wishes. He is making very good progress eating. He's off all the tubes and all of those things that had us a little bit worried in the beginning. So we're thankful for that. If you have not signed up for the bulletin, we did put a bulletin out yesterday again. We hope to do this every Friday. You can sign up on unitedisrael.org. I did want to also remind you that we are fast approaching the seventh biblical month. According to the Jewish calendar, that day arrives on Wednesday as the sun is setting, this coming Wednesday, September the 20th. As the sun sets, we will enter into the first day of the seventh biblical month according to the Jewish calendar. There are, as you know, debates that have been going on since time immemorial about the calendar. So I know that there are people who are watching for the thin crescent, which I am also going to do. But in order to plan things for our online friends, we intend to host here at the United Israel Center South in St. Francisville a day to commemorate Yom Teruah, also known popularly among English speakers as the Day of Trumpets. And Teruah literally means to make noise. And so we hope to make this fun for both young and old. If you're old and grouchy, are young and grouchy and don't like the sound of loud trumpets, you might want to find something else to do, because I tend to allow children to be very noisy anyway. And on Yom Teruah, a day dedicated to a day of noise is going to be a day of noise. So I want to teach some kids how to blow a trumpet, and we might let the grouchy folks do something else that day. But I did intend to teach a little bit, a short class, or talk a little bit about the significance of the day. You know, we don't have a lot of text in the Bible about Yom Teruah. Around that day, there's been quite a bit of tradition that's come up. It is now known among Orthodox and conservative and even Reformed Jews, Judaism in general, has come to recognize the first day of the seventh month, which biblically is only known as Yom Teruah. But according to Judaism, it became associated with the New Year. So you will hear people talk about not Yom Teruah, but about Rosh Hashanah. And as I've pointed out many times, according to Judaism, there's not one New Year. Most people know of two. You know, they think about the religious calendar, Exodus chapter 12, this will be the beginning of months to you. And they think about the civil calendar, which they associate with Rosh Hashanah. But according to the Talmud, there are four New Years. And so Rosh Hashanah being the most known, the most popular Jewish New Year. It's their January 1st, if you want to make a connection there. But anyway, we intend to do that on Wednesday. I set up an event on Facebook. I'd like you to say if you're going. That doesn't mean you're coming here. If you're coming here, let us know you're going to be here in person just so we can plan. But if you're going to be here online, we consider you here. Absent in the body, present in the, you know, you've heard that before. So go ahead and say you're coming. because we want to know who's going to be with us on Wednesday evening, beginning at around 6 p.m. We'll go live and hopefully bring you some fun and information, and I'm sure we'll have some goodies to chew while we're here, some things that we'll put together. In the coming days, we will also begin to post various information about upcoming events beyond the first day. The following Shabbat, 10 days later, not the following immediate, but week from that week, we'll have a Yom Kippur. I'll take that Sabbath and I'll teach on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, on that Saturday. So we get into the festive cycle. The idea is that the festivals were always part of the religious teaching that took place in the ancient world, in the synagogues, even in the temple and so forth. And then those Torah studies were always built around that. In fact, there's evidence that says that according to the most ancient sources, before there was a liturgy, so to speak, where there was this regular reading from the Torah and the prophets, that they always did this. In other words, if your Shabbat falls in line with the holy days, you would talk about the holy days on the Shabbat, the festival cycle. So we'll incorporate that as well. And then Sukkot. Sukkot falls beginning on the 15th day of the seventh month and lasts for 7 days. You're to dwell in temporary dwellings. And this morning already, Dave and Sherry are working up some math on how we're going to build a sukkah out front here at the building at the United Israel Center South. And I will be here during that time, and many people will open this up. And anyone local who wants to come and help us put that together and spend some time with us in the sukkah, you're certainly welcome and encouraged to do so. So, we are in the book of Genesis. let me put it this way. We are still in the book of Genesis. If we were following the annual cycle of readings, we would be almost finished with the entire Torah. And some people might charge that we're slow. But I think that some of you might be. The rest of you are not at all, but this allows us, this triennial cycle of reading, as you know, allows us to really dig down and build the story. In fact, it's caused me to slow down and find some things that I normally wouldn't notice. Because, as you know, the annual cycle of readings, you might do 5 chapters of Torah, and there's quite a bit of content in 5-6 chapters. But when I'm going through this slowly and I'm carefully studying in the Hebrew, I'm beginning to notice some things. So, for instance, this week I'm also doing a study in the book of Deuteronomy, and a phrase hit me, a name actually, the Amorites. And I began to go back and study that. And you know, sometimes in the backstory, we realize that there's a lot of information there. We read over a word, a phrase, a sentence, a verse, and we just skip it, and we miss quite a bit. So think about that, and hopefully these slower workings through, that even sounded Hebraic, these slower workings through of the Torah allow us to dig deep, and that is exactly what we intend to do. We began 2 weeks ago to join a study about Joseph, what I called the Joseph Saga. And we started to work through those texts about Joseph, which I think contains some of the greatest material ever put on paper. I love the Joseph Saga for many reasons. I think not only like the Jacob stories, not only has it been influential in the development of our entire culture and the world in which we live, but the stories contain those foundational elements which not only bring the ancient world to light, but I believe sheds light on what is to come. So if we study closely, if we carefully look at these stories, we're not only learning about history, but I believe we're learning about prophecy, and I hope to share some of those insights with you. And I encourage you to share those insights with me. One of the things that I pointed out last week, we began 2 weeks ago with the Joseph saga, chapter 37 of Genesis. When we got to 38, things seemed to be interrupted, if you will. There was this story that seems and feels to be squeezed into the narrative about Judah. Joseph, as you recall from the last verse of Genesis 37, is taken into Egypt. And chapter 38 of Genesis begins, and it was about that time that Judah went down away from his brothers. And you're like, well, wait a minute, what's going on with Joseph? I'm interested. I'm hooked in the Joseph story. And then we have to read about Judah. But this is important, as I tried to show last week, because for the entirety of chapter 38, the writer wants us to know that behind the scenes, behind this interesting story about Joseph is another story. And so simultaneously, what is beginning to happen in these chapters of Genesis is we are beginning to develop the character, if you will. The reader is being shown things about the two most important sons. And I say the most important. Like, I don't encourage you to do this in your family. Like, I have so many kids, and this one is the most important. What I mean to imply is that these two have very important roles, both within the ancient story as well as the prophetic story. So the writer wants us to see how each of these sons, Judah and Joseph, are being developed, if you will, so that we are in the loop. Now, if you were to leave out chapter 38, like if you were to, don't do this, but if you were to cut and paste, you went into a Word document, and I actually did this, by the way, and you take 38 out, and you set it aside, cut it, move it, and then you read chapter 37 all the way to the end and begin chapter 39, it's like you didn't miss a thing. In other words, if 38 wasn't there, the story of Joseph wouldn't be affected at all. Now, a lot of scholars believe that these kind of things actually happened, that they were later put together. Whether that's the case or not, whether you buy into those theories or not is irrelevant. What I'm suggesting is that you follow me today as we play like, at least at this point, that this Judah story is an unknown. We don't know what Judah's doing. We're focused on Joseph. So I want you to look with me. I'm going to read Genesis chapter 37. I'm not going to read all of it. Relax. I'm going to read the last verse of chapter 37. So if you'll go with me to Genesis 37, verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him, him being Joseph, in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Genesis 39:1. Now Joseph was taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. You follow where I'm going? In other words, 37 ends that Joseph is sold to a man named Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. 39 says, and he was taken down to Egypt and Potiphar and so forth and so on. You see the continuous flow there. It's like the story truly does feel interrupted by chapter 38. Today's class is called The Temptation of Joseph. The Temptation of Joseph. Now, in my studies of the ancient triennial cycle of readings, there are six lists of divisions that came to us from antiquity that we've discovered. In other words, there are these lists. Like if you look at a standard Jewish list of the annual cycle of readings, there are 54 readings. Now, sometimes, depending on the week, certain ones are combined so that you complete the reading in a year in line with the Jewish festivals and so forth. But there are 54 annual readings. Those readings are, everyone can list them off, right? You know these. Bereishi, you have Noach, you have Lech Lecha. You can go on all the way down the list of 54. How many of you can do that right now, off memory? Most of you. Good. Glad to see all your hands raised. Now, with the triennial cycle of readings, it's a little bit more difficult because some of these lists, which have come to us from antiquity, have various places where they divide and stop and start and stop. So it wasn't quite as nailed down as the annual cycle of readings. Now, some within the Jewish community and those who attach themselves to Judah will suggest to you that these things go all the way back to the time of Moses. Not true. And we do know, according to Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 10 and 11, that in antiquity there was a process whereby the people were assembled to read, quote unquote, the Torah in the hearing of all the people. You can read about that, Deuteronomy 31, verses 10 and 11. Interestingly enough, that was to be done in the year of release at the time of Sukkot. So every 7 years, the people would come together and they would read from the Torah and the entirety of the Torah. Now, I don't personally believe that that was Genesis 1:1 through Deuteronomy chapter 34:12, but you're welcome to believe that if you choose. I believe that it was something called HaTorah HaZot, which I am working on a study right now, and it represents the Torah of Moses, which was later built around later by other scribes. I think we can show that by doing some detective work within the Hebrew Bible, within the Torah, as we have received it. But I understand that that is not the traditional view. But when have I ever been totally associated with traditional views, right? But according to these ancient lists, they divided the text differently. So in some cases, according to, for instance, the Leningrad Codex, there are 167 sederim, we call them, different divisions of the text. I tend to go with the Leningrad Codex, and why would I do that? Because this ancient witness, it's known as B19, B as in boy, Leningrad Codex is the oldest witness to the entire Hebrew Bible. So it contains 167 different divisions. They're listed out, and that's on my list. You can get it from my website. You'll notice different columns. Now, why am I bringing all this up? Some of you are like, let's just get on with the class. But I need you to understand that in this particular case, the Leningrad Codex reads or sections off chapter 39, and then the next reading begins in chapter 40. But five other witnesses go from 39 all the way to the end of 40. So you would read 39 and 40, but I decided let's go with this most ancient witness of the Leningrad Codex, because 40 is an entirely new lesson. It's a different thought, and there is a white space. So I trust Leningrad here. That doesn't mean I have any dealings with the Russians, so no one begin to think, right? Some of you might have missed that. Hopefully none of you in the States missed it. Okay, so I elected to follow the Leningrad Codex. Now, what I will do now, if you will follow along with me, I would like to read from the Transparent English Bible, the work of Dr. James Tabor, and we're going to read Genesis 39. Genesis 39, beginning in verse 1, and Joseph was taken down toward Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, chief of the slaughterers, an Egyptian man, acquired him from the hand of the Ishmaelites who had caused him to go down toward there. And Jehovah was with Joseph, and he was a man caused to be prosperous. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that Jehovah was with him, and all he did, Jehovah caused prosper in his hand. Joseph found favor in his eyes and served him and singled him out over his house and all there was to him. He gave into his hand. And it was from then he singled out over his house and over all there was to him. And Jehovah blessed the house of the Egyptian on account of Joseph. And the blessing of Jehovah was in all that there was to him, in the house and in the field. And he left all that there was to him in the hand of Joseph. And he did not know anything that he had, but indeed the bread that he ate. Joseph was beautiful of shape and beautiful of sight. And it was after these things that the woman of his master lifted her eyes toward Joseph and said, "Lie down with me." And he refused and said toward the woman of his master, "Look, my master does not know what's with me in the house, and all that there is to him he's given into my hand. There's none larger in this house from me, and he's not withheld from me anything, but indeed you, because you are his woman. And how can I do this large bad deed and heir to Elohim?" And it was as she spoke toward Joseph day by day, and he did not hearken toward her to lie down beside her to be with her. And it was according to this day, he came toward the house to do his work, and there was not a man from the men of the house there in the house. Everybody say, uh-oh. And she caught him by his clothing, saying, "Lie down with me." And he left his clothing in her hand and fled and went toward the outside. And it was as she saw that he left his clothing in her hand and fled toward the outside. And she called to the men of her house and said to them, saying, "See, he caused to come to us a man, a Hebrew, to laugh with us. He came toward me to lie down with me, and I called in a large voice. And it was as his hearing that I have caused my voice to lift up and called, and he left his clothing near me and fled and went toward the outside." She placed his clothing near her until the coming of his master toward his house. She spoke toward him according to these spoken things, saying, "He came toward me, the Hebrew servant whom you caused to come to us to laugh with me. And it was as I caused my voice to lift up and called, and he left his clothing near me and fled toward the outside. And it was as his master heard the spoken things of his woman that he spoke toward him, saying, 'According to these things your servant has done to me,' and his nose burned. The master of Joseph took him and gave him toward the house of roundness, the place that the bound ones of the king were bound, and he was there in the house of the roundness. And Jehovah was with Joseph, stretched out toward him loyal kindness, and gave his favor in the eyes of the chief of the house of the roundness. And the chief of the house of the roundness gave into the hand of Joseph all the ones bound who were in the house of the roundness, and all that are doing there, and all that they are doing there, he was the one doing. And there was nothing the chief of the house of roundness was seeing under his hand, for Jehovah was with him, and that which he did, Jehovah caused to prosper." Very literal, right? Mm-hmm. House of the roundness, the house of the bound ones, the voice lifting up. Hebrew's very poetic. The idea of this translation is to be as literal as possible, and to allow you as an English reader and me as an English reader to look at the English and almost as if we're peering into the Hebrew. So you get that feel. And clearly, the focus shifts to Joseph in this chapter. Notice the characters within these stories. If you can imagine almost as characters in a play. Screen opens. The characters have certain costumes, if you will. There are events, and this is very dramatic. So my reading might not convey it, but imagine when she calls. She calls out with a loud voice, "Look, he came to me and tried to sleep with me." And the other people imagine in the court going, because they know when the master gets home, and she rehearses this, she practices it in her room, I can imagine. And when the husband comes in, it should be that dramatic. This is a bad deal. Antiquity has stories from Egypt. about similar situations that have come to us in ancient Near East studies. A servant approaches the maiden of the house and tries to sleep with her, or does sleep with her, whatever the case may be. But you have to imagine that this Hebrew, notice, by the way, he's referred to as a Hebrew. This is the first time we've read the word Hebrew since Genesis chapter 14. Now, something that the scholars have noted is that generally a Hebrew is referred to as a Hebrew by foreigners or when the Hebrew is speaking to foreigners. For instance, Jonah, who are you? What are you doing here? I'm a Hebrew and I serve the God, you know. Or when they're talking about the Hebrews living among the children of Egypt, for instance. But this Egyptian woman is referring to the Hebrew who came into their house, and she sort of shifts the blame to her husband. You know, you're the one that hired this Hebrew. You bring him in the house. How could you put this person in our house? And then you go off to work and leave me with this gorgeous guy walking around. So the focus shifts to Joseph. For those of us who are, let's say, in the know, that's us. See, we know what's going on in the plot. Now, I want you to act like you've not read this story before. I brought this up last week in the dialogue, but some of you might not have stayed around for the dialogue, so you have to hear it. This is from the translator's preface from Everett Fox's The Five Books of Moses. This is what he says. Now, he's quoting, it's adapted from a lecture of Martin Buber. If you know Martin Buber, this was from 1926. This is what Buber says, and Fox records it in his book in the introduction. Read the Bible as though it were something entirely unfamiliar, as though it had not been set before you ready-made. Face the book with a new attitude as something new. Let whatever may happen occur between yourself and it. You do not know which of its sayings and images will overwhelm and mold you, but hold yourself open. Do not believe anything a priori. Do not disbelieve anything a priori. Read aloud the words written in the book in front of you. Hear the word you utter and let it reach you. So what are we talking? We're saying don't act like or act like you don't know what's going to happen. It's the first time you've ever heard this story. In fact, it might be the first time you've heard it this way. All right. Judah, though not present in this story, there's no mention of Judah in this story, in chapter 39. But you know that behind the scenes, the Judah story that we covered last week is going on now. Now remember, chapter 38 covered a period that was at least 20 plus years. I mean, he had time to go down and find this woman and sleep with her, you know, Tamar. Remember, his daughter-in-law. He didn't know it was her. But he sleeps with her because he thinks she's a prostitute, which doesn't really make it right either. But the story is going on. She has children. He has sons. I mean, all these things are going on, but we talked about that last week. So this week, we're focusing on Joseph, but I want you to remember that behind the scenes, Judah is learning life lessons as we talk about Joseph. He's learning life lessons in another place, in another way. But nonetheless, he's learning. Despite the separation of the brothers, despite the fact that Joseph is in Egypt going about his life as good or bad as it is or will become, Judah is going about his life, good or bad, as it is or as it will become. The two are learning simultaneously. Now, the reason that's important is because I think that they are supposed to be learning separately, but lessons which will ultimately lead to a reunion of the brothers, right? That's the first thing. As they develop, it's setting the groundwork for a reunion that's going to happen in the story that we're reading in Genesis. But not only in the ancient story, but in some ways in a type, if you will, of the future reunion of the latter-day descendants of both Judah and Joseph. So that hopefully makes sense. Yeah, it's a historical story, we believe. We have reason to believe, as the author put it. But it also speaks beyond their days and beyond the character. Now, I'll give you a couple of for instances. These are things that I believe are indicated by the text, but we might not catch them if we don't pay attention. What I mean is that the stories are simultaneously. Here's an instance. Genesis chapter 38, verse 1, last week, Judah. I want to make sure you get that. This is Judah. It said, Judah went down from his brothers. Now, you know how, notice by the way, that he's away from his brothers. So when Judah goes down, here's the result. He goes down away from his brothers. The result, he's separated from his brothers, right? Everybody follow that? Now, if you go to chapter 39, it says this. Listen to this. Now, Joseph was taken down to Egypt. Now, you might not catch this if you don't pay attention. If you don't see these stories as working in tandem, Judah went down, Joseph is taken down. Now, Judah went down away from his brothers. Now, I want you to understand, he did this of his own free will. Joseph was taken down as a result of a plot of his brothers, but the result is the same. He, too, is away from his brothers. The difference is in the form of the verb, and the writer wants us to see this. One goes down on his own. The other is taken down. The form of the Hebrew verb is different. Not of his own free will, but Joseph, nonetheless, like Judah, is separate from his brothers. Now, these two, I want to make the point going into this story as we develop the themes. I want you to get that. I see Judah and Joseph as both being separate from the brothers. And why is that? Because they will both be singled out, not only in the progression of our story here in the text in Genesis and beyond, but in the prophets and in the prophecies, these two will be singled out. Can't tell you how many times I see people arguing over this as well. You're trying to say that Joseph is this and Judah is this, and I want you to, you know, and they argue this point about, well, the tribes, when they divided, weren't specifically this tribe and that tribe. The picture, the dominant tribes are what we want to focus on, because those themes that show up in the prophets can be traced back to the story in Genesis. The writer wants us to set these two up so that we get it later. So they both go down. Everybody with me? They're both separated from the family. Now, these stories that we're reading weave words, phrases, and themes in their storytelling that masterfully tie together elements of the overall narrative. These recur, like you might not have noticed, I didn't until last night, that the word to go down was used in both of those stories to kick it off. But see, these themes, these ideas, it's like, hey, psst, watch this. Hey, watch this. You just got to look closely. Now, I'll give you another example that something that hit me. When I'm reading it carefully in the Hebrew, probably because my Hebrew is not my native tongue by far, and I'm not that good at it. So when I'm reading it, I have to read it more carefully than I read the English. See, if I'm reading the English, I mean, I memorize a lot of verses like you do in English. You know how when you get so familiar with something, you can't see something you just read over. I do that in English, but not in Hebrew. So something hit me as I was working through to tie these stories together. I'll give you an example. The lifting of the eyes in Hebrew, when I read the phrase in whatever form the verb and the words are used, the lifting of the eyes occurs in two very close stories. And it indicates, so far, a trap for Joseph. The lifting of the eyes represents a trap for Joseph. Now, I will say this. I did a study on every occurrence of every form of the phrase lifting in eyes. Quite often, lifting of the eyes is associated with prophecy. So if you work through, like Zechariah uses it quite a bit. Daniel uses it. Ezekiel uses it. And I lifted my eyes and I saw, and God said, what do you see? And so forth. So it indicates in some ways a prophetic vision. I'm not saying that these that I'm about to cover represent prophecy, but they do tend to be, they do are followed by a trap for Joseph. It's just something I noticed. Let me show them to you. Not once, but twice. Look at chapter 37 of Genesis. Chapter 37, verse 25. The English says, then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Nothing really stands out in that passage. But in the Hebrew, the brothers have just done a dirty deed. They've thrown Joseph into the pit, and they sit down to eat their lunch. Most likely, a lunch that Joseph brought them from Daddy. And while they're eating, and Joseph is in the pit, it's empty. There's no water in it. It says they lifted their eyes, and the plot begins to materialize. Now, you might say, well, that's not a big point. Okay? Now, when we get into our story today, the reason that I bring this up, that lifting of the eyes pulled things together that ended with Joseph being sold into Egypt. In today's class, it says that the woman of the house lifted her eyes towards Joseph. Again, the language, I think, is meant to draw you in. You almost, when you read that somebody lifts their eyes toward Joseph, you ought to go, uh-oh, here it comes. Now, this is not all. You'll see as we work through this. In this week's reading, though, the wife, Joseph's master, raised her eyes to Joseph in a rage due to his refusal. When he tells her, no, I won't sleep with you, she sets in motion the next plot, which puts him in another bad situation. Right? See the connection? Both times, he, Joseph, is presented as innocent. He just, in the first instance, he's going to check on the peace of his brothers, who, by the way, we're told, can't even speak peace to him. They can't even say shalom to him. You ever get so mad at your spouse? I never do. But you ever get so mad at your spouse, and she's never been this mad at me, that they can't even say hi? You don't even speak to one another? This is how this story presents it. Now, both times Joseph is presented as innocent, and then something happens to him. Judah goes down, Joseph is brought down. Okay? Now, go back to 37. Another word that appears in the Joseph story in several places is the word hand, okay? If you look at chapter 37, verse 21 and 22, just to make the point of hand, I'm going to go back into the previous story and show you this connecting theme. And Reuben said to them, see Reuben stepping up, I'm sorry, let me go to verse 21. But when Reuben heard it, he heard about the plot to kill him. He delivered him out of their hands. I want you to focus on the idea of whose hands is Joseph in, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand upon him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." You see that? Like, they want to hand him over to death. They want to hand him over, but Reuben wants to deliver the boy out of their hand. All right? Now, his plan doesn't work, though, does it? But let's look at chapter 37, verse 26. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh," and his brothers heeded him. Right? See, the idea, it's about whose hand is Joseph in. We'll talk about this. But see, he has to be delivered from the hands of his brothers, and Reuben and Judah both tried. Now, Judah's plan puts him with the Ishmaelites. We just read it. He says, "Hey, let's deliver him over to the Ishmaelites." And according to chapter 39:1, now Joseph was taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. Sounds like Judah's plan works. Now, I have to point this out because I'm honest with the text. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't seek to find ideas that work, because I do. This is what I spend my life doing. But I'm honest with you, and I'm honest with myself when I read the text. There is a very big difficulty in this story. Scholars have scratched their head. Apologists have put together some very crafty explanations. But this story of whose hand is Joseph in is very, very complex. Who delivers Joseph? Who actually sells him? Who brings Joseph into Egypt? I mean, this is one of the greatest debates in biblical scholarship, believe it or not. This particular question, because it's almost a who's on first. Now, I know there are people out there, I'm not watching, but there are people out there who are probably typing, "No, it's very easy. Here's the answer. Look here, look here. This is it. This, it all makes perfect sense. Look at me and read my lips." It doesn't. It's not easy. There are difficulties here. This has caused biblical scholarship to say we have ancient accounts which came from different sources that have been brought together, and later it was tried to be smoothed out. Now, I'm not trying to shake your faith here. I'm just showing you something. So here we go. And again, I'm aware of the apologist answers. An apologist is one who seeks to smooth out all the difficulties. We do this. We like to do this. We don't want people to have problems. Here's the fun part for me about biblical study. I love difficulties. I love problems. It's what I mean, if it's just an easy story, you read it and it all makes perfect sense, and anybody can do that. So I want to point out a few things. Let's just move forward to chapter 37, verse 28. The Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So a lot of people stop here and they go, "Oh, well, there you go. Judah's talking about the Ishmaelites. The Midianites come into the story. They pull him out the pit, but you get him back to the Ishmaelites. Problem solved. Ishmaelite, Midianite, Ishmaelite. We're good." Right? So who has him? The Ishmaelites? Not so fast. Look at chapter 37, verse 36. Now remember, the Ishmaelites have him in verse 28. Go to verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. What are the Midianites doing in the story? I thought they gave him to the Ishmaelites. Now, some might say it really doesn't matter. Midianite, Ishmaelite, Midianite, these are all descendants of Abraham. Well, it doesn't say descendants of Abraham. I want to follow this mystery, and I'm not going to solve it for you. I want you to deal with it, too. You have to take notes. You have to do your research. In fact, in verse 36, the translations, most translations say Midianite, just like before. But technically and literally, the Hebrew doesn't even say Midianite. It's another group. It says the Midianites. Right? Who is that? That's a whole other group. You get the impression like Joseph is shackled and he's like, come on. I mean, somebody just get me to where I got to go. Y'all keep shuffling me off. All right. Now, if you go to verse 1 of 39, remember we just said the Midianites have him? 39 verse 1. Now, Joseph was taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. Ishmael, Midian, 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 Ishmael. Who's got Joseph? Now, before, I just brought that up because it's fun. I mean, I spent time working through that last night, charting, okay, who's got him when and what chapter and what verse. You ought to see the notes. I'm not going to do this because people would probably make fun of my writing, but I would almost scan that page and post it up. And there are a lot of stories like this, but I love this kind of stuff. Okay, so some, by the way, I know of all the arguments pro and con. I say all. I've read quite a few of them. Some people will say, well, the Midianites are actually Ishmaelites. Well, of course they're going to say that because we're looking for ways to erase any difficulties. But the text is not that simple, folks. The Bible knows how to say Ishmael. It knows how to say Midian. And these people are different. They're different people. Okay, enough of that, maybe. But before we leave the Ishmaelites, I want to observe one more point. Go to chapter 37:28. The Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Now, Joseph, I didn't mean to shake you now. Forget who sold him and who brought him and who had him and whatever. Let's get past that. Here we read that the Ishmaelites paid 20 shekels of silver to the Midianites for Joseph. 20 shekels of silver. I believe that Joseph knows what's going on. Joseph knows that his brothers were involved in a transaction which resulted in him being sold into slavery for 20 shekels of silver. Why do I know that? Let me show you something that I found. Actually, let me give credit to a teacher of mine, Richard Elliott Friedman. I say a teacher of mine. I read his books. I respect his scholarship. He said, he pointed this out. I would have never noticed it. Joseph, the price is 20 shekels of silver. Now, later in our story, remember when the boys come and they're coming to get food and Joseph makes sure that some silver is put back in their bags? He does this twice in the back and forth. Do you remember? In the first account, Benjamin is not with them. You can't count Joseph, right? How many sacks go back? Because now, don't do your math too quick. because Simeon is held back. Nine. So there are nine sacks that have silver when they go back. And they realize it. They're like, the money's in the bag. Nine. They go back. Right? Remember, Jacob's like, you got to get the man the money back. I mean, there's obviously been an oversight, but he's what? Don't keep that money. Right? Remember the story, back and forth. So they go back in the next encounter. Guess what? They've got all the boys. Joseph doesn't count. They start leaving. Benjamin's with them. They all have money. How much money? 11 sacks. 11 and 9 is 20. What Friedman points out is this is under the score. It's like right under the sheet there. You can see that he's playing with them. I mean, on the surface, he's playing with them. You don't have to do any math to figure that out. He's toying with them a little bit, right? But the fact that he sends back and it totals to 20, it's almost like, hey, you want 20 things of silver? Talk about. Okay, interesting point, at least to me. Friedman says that it hints at an ironic payback to the brother's deception. That's his quote. All right, but we're not there yet. Forget I told you about the sacks. Act like you don't know anything about that. You don't know anything about it. Just focus on the story today, if I would let you do that. Joseph is in Egypt. Now, the first phrase that we say, that we notice is something that is very important in this particular story. It's so important, it's repeated four times. You ready for it? Jehovah was with Joseph. Jehovah was with Joseph. Now, in verse 2, it's just stated as a fact. Let me just go through them. Verse 2, 39:2. Jehovah was with Joseph. Right? Now, if you look at verse 3, it says, and his master saw that Jehovah was with him. So the first time it occurs, it's just stated as a fact. Jehovah was with Joseph. The next time it says somebody else noticed it. See? It's one thing to state it. It's another thing for somebody else to notice it. Like I can say, man, I feel like the Lord's with me. But if my life is such that other people look at me and go, you know something about that guy, the Lord's with him. You see the difference? One is sort of like, you know, You recognize it, and I hope you do recognize God's working in your life. Second is when somebody else does. Now, if you go down to verse 21, chapter 39, verse 21, but Jehovah was with Joseph. Now look at verse 23. The keeper of the prison paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care because Jehovah was with him. You see, it's the same. It's a mirror, right? In the first one, Joseph noticed it, and then the master of his house noticed it. Then, in prison, it's stated as a fact, just like in verse 2. Verse 21 is like verse 2. It says that he knew that God was with him. Verse 23, another person notices it. It says the prison guard didn't have to worry about anything because everything was put in Joseph's hand because he knew God was with him and was prospering him. I guess this leads me to a question. I think it's easy for us in good times to say or believe that God is with us. But can we or do we, more importantly, do we still feel that way when things aren't going so good? So it's sort of a question I want you to entertain. How do we, you know, Dave's always saying, well, how does this relate to us? Think about that for a moment. When we're in good times, it's easy to say, boy, I'm blessed, hallelujah, hashtag blessed. I mean, I'm living my life and God's blessing me. But what happens when things don't go well? Do we say, uh-oh, I don't feel it anymore. I'm only feeling God when things are going my way. Just a question. Did you notice that Joseph, as a result of Jehovah being with him, that he was prosperous, successful, and found favor. Did you notice those things? Again, whether in good times or bad, those same words are used to describe his state. I mean, it says he's in prison and God prospered him. He was successful. You can be successful in jail. Now, you have to redefine success and prosperity, right? You know, somebody might say, man, I wish I had his money. Or I wish I was successful like that. Or I wish I was as popular as that Torah teacher. That Torah teacher is better looking than I am. He's this, he's that, she's this, she's that. I wish I had their car. I wish I had their kids or whatever. You know, it's easy. But what we have to do is look at our blessings as our blessings. These are things that belong to us. Now, we read that blessing comes to others because Jehovah is with Joseph. I like this because I hadn't really thought about it, because I've always thought that blessing, you know, the patriarchal promise, and you'll be a blessing and all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. You know, I've always thought about that on a big macro scale, but it works in the micro. Joseph goes into the house of Potiphar and everything he touches is gold. Like literally, in Potiphar's house, it may have been literally gold. But my idea, I want you to get this, is that when he would do something, it would prosper. But it brought blessing to Potiphar too, right? So in a way, these stories indicate that this principle is already at work on the micro, which is another challenge I give to each of us. We don't have to wait on Israel collectively, Judah and Joseph, to come together to begin blessing the world around us. You know the old expression, you might not be able to fix the world, but you might be able to fix somebody's world. Think about looking for opportunity. I know you do, but think about that. You fix one person's world, it's as if you fixed the entire world. You save one life, it's as if you've saved the entire life. Smile at someone who's having a bad day, right? See, I could make big money doing this motivational speaking stuff, right? But I've chosen another profession. I'm prosperous in another way. Okay. Success was in his hand, we're told. Now, here's our word. Previously in the story, we're talking about delivering his life from someone else's hands. And then the transfer of Joseph into the hands of all these different people groups. Ishmaelites, Midianites, Midianites, Ishmaelites, whoever. All the transfer of hand. Now we're reading that success is in his hand. Notice it's because God has prospered him. By the way, everything is put in Joseph's hands. His master says, look, I'm not worried about anything. You know, mi casa su casa. Everything that's mine is yours. You come in here, you can listen to the stereo, Joseph. You're welcome to bathe. You can do whatever. Help yourself to the fine china. Eat whatever you want, whatever. Actually, no, the food is the one exception. Chapter 43, verse 26, I'm sorry, 43, verse 32 gives us a hint at this. Egyptians don't eat with Israelites. Isn't that ironic? Because now Israelites don't eat with anybody, right? You can't eat with them because it might not be kosher. So don't be so hard on the Egyptians. The Egyptians had a similar view. They didn't want to eat with those filthy Hebrews anyway, right? So next time you're among friends and you stick your nose in the air and say, I won't eat with you. I'm an Israelite. We don't eat with pagans. Think about how Joseph felt. Look, you can do anything, but stay your tail out the kitchen. You're just not welcome there. Okay. Now to top it off, Joseph's got all this good going on. Everything's in his hand. He's welcome to use the property. Everything is good to go. But here's something that's interesting here. On top of everything going Joseph's way, He's fine. He's gorgeous. Not only do things work out in his favor, he's good looking. He's the total package, right? I mean, think about this. You know, this phrase, by the way, we're told that he's good looking. This phrase is only used one other time in the Hebrew Bible. In chapter 29, verse 17, it's used for Rachel. That same exact phrase. Now, it's translated differently because, like, have you ever told a grandson or something? Like, I'll say, man, Kalel, you look gorgeous today. He'll say, don't say that. That's for girls. Say, now, gorgeous is boys and girls. You look good. You look good is what I'm saying. He said, well, just say good. See, we have different ways of saying it. So in when it describes Rachel, a translation might say beautiful and fair to look at. In the discussion of Joseph, we might say he's handsome and nice to the eyes or something. But in our modern expression, he would be called hot, right? You say he's hot. Do they still say that? This person's hot. John said, I don't know. What are you asking me for? I'm not up with the times. Imagine if we had God's favor and we were all good looking. You know, when I grew up, I heard that's what heaven was. You know, we'll all be in the best shape of our life, like 18, gorgeous, muscular, fit, you know, whatever. I do want to tell you this funny interlude, this funny story that happened this week. So I've been at the hospital a lot, and I have a very attractive bag that goes with me everywhere I go. That bag is fine, and I bought it in Israel, and I'm proud of it, and everybody knows I'm proud of it. And I was on an elevator with a bunch of women. I was the only guy on the elevator, and one of these women, I assume she was a nurse, said, that is one fine bag. Now, I knew she was talking to me. I didn't even know that others didn't have bags, but I know I've got a fine bag. And I looked at her, made eye contact, realized immediately she's talking to me. I said, it is a fine bag. I said, it's a perfect bag. She said, this is exactly her words, she said, a perfect bag for a perfect man. Now, I got a little nervous. Now, there's a room full of people. I mean, it wasn't like she was going to tell me to sleep with her like this woman did to Joseph, but I did get a little bit blushed. Well, thank God we were at the right stop. The elevator dings, and I get out, and I said, don't know about that last part, but the bag is perfect. As the doors closed, she said, perfect man, perfect bag. So I get out at the hospital, and, you know, I'm waiting in the lobby for the visitation hour to show up. And a little while later, Emily and her husband, who can go in before me, come out. She's sitting down. This woman, same woman, and a few other people, a few other ladies are walking by, and she said, there he is, perfect man with a perfect bag. And Emily sees the whole thing. Now, this was funny. So this is the funny part. So she said, Daddy, did that woman just said that to you out loud? I said, Emily, relax. It happens all the time. I get this all the time. I said, you just happen to witness one of these harassments. I said, it happens everywhere I go. So I played it off. Emily said, do you know that woman? And I didn't lie. I said, no, I don't know her. So that was the story. She immediately told Callie, you ain't believe this. Daddy's sitting there, perfect man. So I'm saying all that because it's a funny story, and I got a kick out of it. Now, again, this woman didn't approach me like the woman in the story, but I want you to recognize that there is a real something we ought to be aware of. You know, sometimes things like that, I'm joking, but sometimes people get lured in. Now, this woman evidently in our story harassed Joseph constantly. I mean, he's not married, right? I mean, as far as we know, he's not married yet, but she continues to mess with him all the time. Hey, come sleep with me. Come lie next to me. Just come over here and let's listen to music. Come here, whatever, whatever. And he continues to put her off. She's growing more and more frustrated with his push-offs, right? And then it says she lifts her eyes toward him. Like she's, it's almost like she's going to put everything she has into alluring him into committing this act. Now, the thing that I find interesting is that when you read this story, Joseph calls this, and I'm using the English translation, I'll get to Tabor in a minute, but it says sin against God. Okay? He says that doing this thing with her would be a sin against God. Now, first of all, it's the first time that he's mentioned God in our story. I'm not going to say it's the first time he's mentioned God. It's the first time in the story we read that Joseph mentions God. But he's recognizing that sleeping with a woman who belongs to another is a crime, basically. It's an error, right? And whenever we read that, the Ten Commandments aren't given yet. There's, you know, you just have to understand that these rules, these norms, societal norms, go back even before there was the giving of the Torah, if you will, right? It's been passed down through this family. Now, the next point I discovered last night, and I want you to stay with me on this. Tabor translates it heir to Elohim. Right? Sin against God. Heir to Elohim. It's saying the same thing. Heir to Elohim. E-R-R. Right? Now, this is a grammatical point. So I'm not going to go into the details. Well, I'll go into the details for people who want to look at this. But the rest of you don't think you have to memorize this. Where it's translated heir, the root word is kata, which is translated to sin, to miss, you know, something like that. And in this exact form, the call perfect, first common, singular, consecutive. You got all that? It only occurs three times in Genesis. This root word, chata, in this grammatical form. Three times. Once here with Joseph, and two times by another person. Who do you think that is? One time Joseph does it, Judah. Judah uses this exact form of basically, I sin, or it would be accounted to me as an heir to God. He uses it twice. I just want to read those verses to you so you get a snapshot of how God is developing both people. Joseph's temptation and the avoidance to sin is comparable to the development of Judah in these places. Go to chapter 43, verse 9. 43, verse 9. This is Judah talking. Actually, let's read verse 8. Chapter 43, verse 8, and Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be surety for him. Of my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. That is the same grammatical form, bear the blame forever. In other words, he's saying, like Joseph says, if I commit this crime, it will be an heir to Elohim. He's saying, I'll be blamed. Same word. Now, this makes a whole lot more sense in Hebrew, I think. But look at verse 32, chapter 44 of 32. I'm sorry, verse 32 of chapter 44. For your servant, this is later when Judah is telling Joseph, for Your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame in the sight of my father all my life. Now, here's what I want you to get from this. Progress is being hinted at in our story. Both of the sons, Judah and Joseph, are learning that sins to the father, heirs, E-R-R, to the father, earthly and heavenly, will prevent the full reunion. They're being taught that they must assume responsibility and act accordingly in order to bring about the reunion. I don't think they know this yet, but I think the writer wants us to know this. Now, the Joseph story makes a point of the garments. And so it is in this week's reading. In particular, a garment, now get this, a garment belonging to Joseph, once again, is being used to tell a lie about him to another person who loved him. A garment that belongs to Joseph is being used by another to tell a lie about him to a person who cared about him. Remember in the first one? They bring the bloody garment to daddy. He's out of his clothes. Garment goes to the person who loved him, and the person says, he's dead. A beast has eaten him. In this story, he's stripped of his garment once again. Now, this is a little thing that I thought of. So there represents the bloody coat. Here represents his garments at Potiphar's house. So there, he's stripped of his garment by jealous brothers. Here, by a rejected woman. There, it was used to say he was dead. Here, it was used to suggest that he should be dead. There, he wasn't really dead. And here, he won't be put to death. In both cases, Joseph's garment are presented as evidence. There, he went into servitude in Egypt. Here, he's thrown into prison. But in both cases, and get this, Jehovah was with Joseph. And he prospered. He was successful. And everything was placed in his hands. With everything that Joseph goes through, he's learning through the things that he suffers. And I believe that we too learn in the adversity that we face day to day. He's learning to do good in whatever place he finds himself, whether favored by his father, whether hated by his own blood, whether in a place where he's favored by both man and God, or hated by those who contrive lies about him. From riches to rags to riches to rags again, wherever Joseph goes, this thing is true. Jehovah is with him. Shabbat shalom.